This episode of IPv6 Buzz is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Start or grow your IT career with online training from IT Pro TV. And here's a special offer for IPv6 Buzz listeners. Sign up now and save 30% off all plans. Visit itpro.tv/buzz for 30% off all plans. Use the promo code Buzz at checkout. That's itpro.tv/buzz and use the promo code Buzz at checkout.
Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-host Tom Coffey and Scott Hoag. And today you're getting the three of us to talk about some weird IPv6 stuff. Sort of random things that we've sort of observed over the last little bit. And we thought we'd have some fun talking about some of them because, hey, they're amusing. So, and I think with that, maybe we jump in and just sort of talk about some strangeness that we've seen in regards to either maybe vendors who are publishing stuff or like documentation that we've seen or just weird things on Twitter that have gone on back and forth. So I think that's what we want to cover today. So what are we kicking it off with? We're kicking off with addresses. Is that what we were going to start with?
Yeah. I mean, it's just IPv6 being new to people, to vendors, to developers. They may not know some of these constructs, you know, and these constructs or numbering schemes maybe haven't been written down well or socialized or made it into the collective consciousness. So some people color outside the lines if they don't know where the lines are, you know.
Yeah,
and it's just lack of familiarity with IPv6. But then also in some ways, the creativity can open up some new frontiers. And that's one of the great things about IPv6.
Well, and we're guilty of this too. So don't think that we're perfect. So as one of the insight things that we joke about is, you know, we're all very familiar and aware of the documentation prefix because that's a really common thing. And it's available in V4 too. Most people don't know about it. And be honest, the V4 documentation prefix address space is too small to be sort of practical or useful. But The reality is we have a documentation prefix for V6, but there is actually a format standard for V6 too. And funny enough, we've had to redo some of our materials to conform to the format standard.
Yeah, but we have to go. I think you have to go all the way back to the beginning, which is the, right. I mean, hexadecimal, right? It shouldn't be an issue, but because we have it in MAC addresses, and obviously, if you have a programming background or a formal CS education, you're probably not too intimidated by hexadecimal and converting to decimal and binary or even octal, heaven forbid. But yeah, you know, like Scott mentioned the creativity, that's something that you certainly have available to you with the hexadecimal characters, as long as you realize what the limits of the hexadecimal characters are. So we've seen some interesting letters of the alphabet showing up in IPv6 addresses.
Yeah, definitely. I'd encourage people to just open up their calculator application on their computer and, you know, change it to the programmer mode, you know, and then they see hex, decimal, octal, binary, you know, and they could type in some numbers and see what you see and try to understand why that is what it is. Yeah.
And turning your calculator over to get additional letters is not acceptable. Turning it upside down to get additional letters doesn't fit the standards.
Yeah, doing hello and spelling it upside down, that doesn't work? That doesn't count?
No, it does not count. Well, I think let's walk everyone through it. So we count, you know, 0 to 9, right? And then because we're hexadecimal, we're like, well, that only got us, you know, 10 actual slots. Where's the rest, right? So it's We start at A and we cover A, B, C, D, E, and F. And that gets us the range sets that's required for hexadecimal.
And then all the possible word letter combinations, creating actual pronounceable and meaningful words in English or another language, if you care to use the English alphabet.
Right, you can spell most of Tom's last name. Coffee.
Everything but the N.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny. So you'll see a lot of people that write example documentation that says things like cafe. And if you're really old in the V6 world, you'll see like dead beef. Right? Mm-hmm. There's certain ones that you'll see over and over again that people had a tendency to use to express this. And there are even commercial agencies. If you go and look up the Quad A record for Facebook's public website, they actually do some fun tricks in there to spell out Facebook. Now, obviously, it's there's no K, but they did it with C. But you know, whatever, it's that you can actually see and that they're putting a portion of their name actually in the actual IPv6 address.
I wonder what that would look like in Cyrillic, apropos of nothing.
It would be RFC 5514, which is IPv6 over social networks, which was an April Fool's RFC by our good friend Eric Venk.
That's right.
Yeah, check that one out.
Yeah, and I think the address thing is interesting because many people don't know. So the documentation prefix is 2001:DB8:32, right? And so that documentation prefix you're going to see over and over again. Hopefully, you're going to see over and over again in examples where when you're reading someone else's documentation, as opposed to seeing some made up or an actual public address space range, you should be seeing something in the documentation range, hopefully. That's not always the case. And in fact, in older documentation, you may see some retired address space. I think it's pretty common still to see stuff from Sixbone. Mm-hmm. I still read and see stuff from Sixbone. And
how do we recognize that?
Well, that entirely depends on whether they wrote it out for you as being a Sixbone address or whether you actually recognize the address space.
Three FFE, right? And then there's a second prefix that I forget.
Yeah, so the 3FFE:/16 is probably the most common one that everyone sort of recognizes as being the Sixbone. And I think that's the one that I've seen a lot of documentation, older documentation, like much older. I'm talking like circa prior to 2010, probably. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's fair. Probably maybe even circa before that, maybe even before 2007. It's probably more common to see stuff with Sixbone examples. At least that's been my experience.
And yeah, now they pretty much
transitioned all to, or at least I found all of them to documentation prefix, except for the weird ones where I see where they're just using a random made up. They'll use like 3000 or they'll use 9000 or they'll use something that they just think they're allowed to use out of a random address range, which even though it's held in reserve, right, by IANA saying like, hold on a sec, we haven't allocated this address space yet, right?
Yeah, I remember my first IPv4 network in 1990. I used 123.45.67. I didn't know what an address was. So I just knew that if I stuck in those numbers, it kind of worked. And whatever the last number was, it didn't matter. And I didn't know what it was until I tried to connect this thing to the internet. And then an old graybeard yelled at me like, that's not what addresses are for. And I was like, what? And, so vendors not knowing, you know, that the internet assigned number authority is a thing and we have rules for how the internet works and how we, you know, control the use of numbers. They use 2::3::4:: in examples. Yeah, they do 2000:: 3000:: 4000:: in their examples. They with complete disregard, and it makes Tom probably cringe when he sees that.
Yeah, it's not as if we don't have enough problems already with representing IPv6 addressing and prefixes. Because for me, being on the address planning side of things and focusing on that, the documentation prefix isn't big enough. If I want to show examples of service providers and all I have to play with is a /32, then I'm relegated to actually having to use illegal address space, quote unquote, illegal address space. Either I'm going to use some address space that's already allocated and potentially step on somebody's actual network in my example, or I'm going to use, you know, something that, like, if I use a Sixbone prefix and then everyone's like, hey, he doesn't know that Sixbone is deprecated. What's wrong with him? You know, so yeah, we need to, you know, and this is something, maybe we have to take this up with the IETF. It's like, we need a bigger documentation prefix for IPv6 so that we can do service provider examples. If a service provider gets a /24 or a /28, you know, how do I represent that? How do I represent having upstream connections to multiple ISPs that are, you know, announcing /32s? And I can't, I've just got one 2001 /32, and I'm done. So yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah, I agree. And I've seen other folks that have used ULA address space too, where they've said, here's some ULA address space, and they recognize that they're doing that. They write it that way, but they're like, you know, here's an example to show you, so that way we know you can't put it in there, it won't route. And there are safeguards in there for the documentation prefix. So most platforms will not forward that stuff outbound. But that's not a guarantee. So you do need to be cautious. If you set your lab up with documentation prefix space, just realize hopefully your upstream is filtering that stuff, because they should have some sort of bogon list and include, right, mm-hmm. the documentation prefix and drop that to the floor, hopefully.
Well, and so we're always being hard on the vendors. It's like, come on, include IPv6 examples in your documentation. And then they finally do. And it's like, no, you did it all wrong, because it's not even, that's not even a real IPv6 address. It's like, we can't win.
Google used to have the Google IPv6 allow list, and now they have the Google IPv6 block list. And if you look in the block list, it has 2001 DB8, because they want to filter out source addresses of DNS lookups going to their, you know, public name servers. And so you as a content provider, you have a name server, you want to block packets coming to you that have been sourced from that, because someone might be using that in their lab environment. It, you know, it tags the source address, it leaves the network somehow, it comes to you, you can't return it, so you should just drop it. Yeah, the same thing with unique local addresses. We often see vendors examples that do FC00, and it's not even the correct range to use. Or if you take that vendor's example out of their documentation, try to use it in your own lab, you might have mixed results. Like, they might have just put in some random addresses into their documentation and not thoroughly tested it, mm-hmm. that it actually works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it won't actually come up. Or mm-hmm. or you'll have weirdness where one vendor will take the FC address, no problem. But another vendor's like, that's not permitted by the RFC, that's held in reserve, so I'm only going to accept FD.
Right. And then you have to deal with the RFC, not 3484, it's the new one that's dealing with host preference for inbound and outbound addresses. Mm-hmm. And how are they going to handle that? So it's really a roll of the dice if you're using that space.
Your address selection policy demotes it. You connect your Windows laptops into your lab, wonder why they aren't interacting with this vendor product. You've gone through their documentation that you've followed. You've configured things. The Windows hosts deprecating the ULA address space, or the Windows host being in an isolated lab, don't have access to the internet, can't do network connectivity status indicator, and just shut down V6 altogether. And you're wondering why your stuff isn't working in your lab.
Yep. And there's all sorts of weirdness. And this is all just from address space, folks. So, all right. Mm-hmm. In terms of thinking through it, I mean, the documentation prefix is super useful. It's super useful to both build labs and also to write documentation. But just realize there are limitations around it, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing like testing with real address space that you can use out on the public V6 internet.
And how can folks get real address space?
Well, there's a couple different ways. If you just want to play around at home, I think Hurricane Electric, tunnelbroker.net is probably a fantastic way to just get mm-hmm. started.
Allocate hopefully, you a /48 still, is that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, they'll still allocate you 48. And then, you know, if you're lucky enough to just be a Comcast subscriber or one of the other, you know, major cable providers who's already rolled out V6, you might already have it, mm-hmm. in which case you've got a dual stack environment, you've got some address space already, and you can start playing with it. There's no reason you can't. So you can just check on your local machine and see if you actually have, you know, global unicast V6 addresses.
And by doing it that way, by having a valid global unicast address, you're sort of going to avoid all those other possible troubleshooting contingencies where you're like, is this address being deprioritized, or does the stack not even recognize it? Or so it's definitely the safe way to play if you're building a lab.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the three of us saw a crazy, wacky vendor lab environment.
That's right.
We saw a vendor trying, you know, to use link local addresses, but instead of FE80, they used FE90, and
which is surprise 10
to us.
Yeah,
just added a 1 and 1 0 to the end of it, and to our shock and amazement, the vendor was able to ping their interface using an FE90 address. So your mileage may vary by quite a lot.
Yeah, this was quite baffling to the three of us. So it was a great deal of entertainment, at least on our side, mm-hmm. Of just like, how is that working? Why does that even work? How did that even make it into something that someone would try? And it happened to be we were working with someone who was relatively new with V6. And so FE90 didn't look any different to them than FE80. in terms of like a legitimate address. They're like, yeah, okay, well, if you're telling me this FE something, then that looks good to me and it's just a link local. So I'll set this up on this device. And we were just like blown away that they could ping back and forth. And
it was crazy that the device would even accept that as an address in the input and apply that then to an interface, which would then have some behavior of responding to an ICMP echo request.
Yeah. I don't even know how the neighbor discovery even worked and like how maybe the network stack for the operating system. Like there's all sorts of, there's turtles the whole way down. I was like, how is this working? Like,
It was
an enlightening moment of realizing that it's a mere miracle that the internet works at all.
Talking about bounds checking, about 10 years ago, I was teaching an IPv6 class at a large company, and a student in the back of the class was having a tough time entering an address, IPv6 address space, and then the address into a Cisco IOS router. It kept giving an error message. And I was like, okay. So I went back, to check on the student what the problem they were having. And I kept looking at it and I was like, that's really interesting. I said, but after a little bit, I was like, wait a minute, those are some fat zeros, those are capital O's. Like, the student saw my examples on the slides, thought instead of zeros that an O was a valid hex digit, was trying to type it into a device and was getting an error message. At least it didn't accept the address and apply it to the interface. But I was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be a long week of IPv6 class. But everything worked out.
Well, that's so funny because there's a similar thing around some documentation that we've seen from some vendors talking about example addresses where they have exactly, they are using O's, but they're lowercase O's and they're lowercase L's and lowercase K's and lowercase J's. And I'm like, wow, that's an interesting V6 address. I don't know. It's clearly, I'm hoping it wasn't tested against an actual interface to come out that way.
Yeah. So, I mean, the documentation here hasn't been run. It's an example of how to configure a service or a product. They obviously didn't test it. The marketing team said, okay, well, let's obfuscate it and just change it. I mean, it could be the marketing team, like, right. Oh, we need to make this not,
obvious.
So it's probably redact this.
Well, and it happens to be a DNS quad A record type. And I don't know if does bind actually check the format for V6 addresses to ensure that it's actually a legitimate address for quad A, or will it publish any set of characters?
Good question.
I don't know. It might not load the zone file. When you
if it's not a legitimate V6 address, I have no idea.
When you go to hup named-y, as they say in the past,
right. But the reason I ask this question is because I do know Bind will accept compressed addresses, right? You can you can do a :// and do ::1 if you wanted to, just for if you wanted to publish that for any given reason, and it will do the loopback address no problem. So I don't know if it doesn't check, if it just says any alphanumeric character is, as long as it's fits in the format characteristic, but not necessarily the character, match, that does it accept it? I guess that's something we need to, this is the stuff that us as experienced people, we don't think about because we're like, oh, well, why would anyone ever do that?
Yeah, that's right.
So we don't go out around and test this stuff. And so clearly we have something to add to our lab of like, oh, we should test this and figure out what the heck is going on.
Well, and I think the advice for the listeners who are new to IPv6 is go, do your homework to figure out to learn what the actual reserved blocks of IPv6 are and what they're for. We've talked about unique local, we've talked about link local, we've talked about the global unicast, et cetera.
Yeah, and there's some old deprecated ones, site local.
Yeah, some old ones. Right? That's right. But they're not like dozens. I mean, there's just a handful to learn, and once you know them, then you pretty much know what you should expect to see in any given example. And I think a follow up to that would also be, and this is kind of a newer thing, RFC 5952, which is kind of telling you the format that those addresses should be presented in, because we're still seeing a lot, we're likely to see a lot of variation in that area for years to come, where, and as an example, not everybody compressing the address as much as they could, and insisting on printing all 32 characters of the address, or more frequently, the confusion between, does this need to be uppercase or lowercase? And different different operating systems spit out in uppercase and different operating systems in lowercase. And the recommendation in 5952 is that it's all lowercase.
Mm-hmm. And a bunch of the vendors don't conform to this. So if you're on Cisco Nexus OS, it's all uppercase.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Cisco devices, it's uppercase. It's like, wow, you're shouting at me.
That's right. IPv6. So what, you know, and there are ramifications for that, right? I mean, if you're writing regular expressions, or, you know, you're looking, you're parsing through logs, you need to sort of be able to anticipate what the format's going to be in. And these days, it's, you know, still a little bit of the Wild West there.
Hello, IPv6 Buzz listeners. We're taking a quick break to tell you about the IT training experts at IT Pro TV. Did you know a recent study at MIT found that IT occupations have grown by 19.5% between 2004 and 2019? That's more than 8 times the growth rate for other jobs over the past decade. While the earnings growth for those with college degrees has somewhat flattened since 2000, earnings have actually grown significantly for individuals working in IT. And it's never too late to start a new career in IT or move up the ladder. And IT Pro TV has you covered, from CompTIA and Cisco to EC Council and Microsoft. IT Pro TV brings you more than 4,000 hours of on-demand training. Their engaging hosts present information in a talk show format. They're live every day, and shows go studio to web in just 24 hours. Courses are conveniently listed by category, certification, and job role. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide via Chromecast, Roku, Apple TV, on PC, or on their iOS or Android apps. Learn IT, pass your certs, and get a great job with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/buzz for 30% off all plans. Use the promo code buzz at checkout. That's itpro.tv/buzz and use the promo code buzz at checkout. One more time, say it with me, itpro.tv/buzz and use that promo code buzz at checkout to save 30% off all plans. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah, and you're gonna deal with these devices for a long time. That code may not get upgraded, and they may never change it.
That's right.
And so, in which case, if you're writing in regular expressions, you need to put, you know, in case, right, and A-F, and right, or whatever the your format is for capital and lowercase, right, to be able to capture everything, so that you know you want to capture, you know, 0 through 9, lowercase A through F, uppercase A through F, right?
Yeah.
So that you're gonna make sure that, you know, you're gonna catch on that regular expression all the match case conditions that might go on, because you're going to be getting different stuff. And hopefully you've got some sort of log in your seam that actually normalizes your data for you.
Exactly. So
it does things like fully expand your address and doesn't take a compressed address, but it still keeps the compressed address to match against. So in case you try and match against a compressed string, right, a zero compression string, that is actually going to match that use case.
Yeah. Right? I mean,
or expand it out. Either one, doesn't matter.
People may want to listen to our show with Dan York talking about applications and how you're coding and you take in an input from a user, you take in their input and you need to check if that's a valid address. And if you just Googled IPv6 regular expression, regex, you'll find it's quite complicated to create a really good quality regular expression match in whatever your coding language is, to check all possible cases of input and 64FF9B, you know, NAT64 addresses, mm-hmm. with a 32-bit, you know,
embedded,
quad dotted decimal at the end, all different kinds of things. Very difficult. But oftentimes many programming languages will have a function that says is IPv6. So, and you can check, you know, true or false. If at is address, is valid IPv6 address, then this. If not, then give an error message. You know, so there may be built-in functions, depending on different languages, to do bounds checking and input validation if it's a valid address first, and not have to do all the regex because it's already been built for you in that function.
But you still have to do a few where it's a completely legitimate address to use the documentation prefix. Mm-hmm. So that will pass the bounds check, no problem.
Yes.
Yeah. But so you'll have to do additional work, as Tom mentioned before, of knowing sort of the inbound and out of bound of address ranges that make sense. Like link local addresses will pass this bounds check also, but you would never use that as a global address, right? It can't be used that way. So
yeah, and 3000::: wouldn't match a bounds check. It's part of the, you know, valid, you know, aggregatable global unicast range, you know, but hasn't been allocated.
Right, hasn't been allocated, so it's still technically sort of semi-reserved right now. Right, it's being held in the back pocket for it to be released to the RIRs once we actually, you know, assign enough 2,000 address spaces. It's going to take a long time to assign 2,000 address spaces.
Yeah, we've also seen service providers, you know, create some interesting documentation to their customers about how big of a prefix they might be delegated to their home. And one wireless service provider who will remain nameless at this point, their documentation says that if you request a /56 from them, you'll get 56 LANs. And I was like, wow, that's pretty amazing.
So
I didn't know it worked that way. That's so simple. Tom often says IPv6 addressing is simple. And now I totally believe.
Yeah, it's just weird though. The larger allocation you get, the fewer LANs you have.
If you only have a /32, then you only have 32 LANs.
That's right. Yeah.
That's smaller.
Yeah. Well,
then I'm going with /128.
Perfect.
Well, and I think that's probably just a natural, like the poor editor doesn't know and someone technical didn't review it, right? And so out to the internet it went and you know, it'll remain that way until someone points it out to them. So
yeah.
I don't know if it really hurts anyone. It's maybe just wrong expectations about what you're going to be delivering to your customer. I suppose the downside is that maybe someone could hold their feet to the fire and from a contract basis and say that this is what you do or do not owe me.
If you think through it though, I think I can guess what happened there, right? So if you have a /56, that's 256 /64s. Yeah, and somebody saw that 256 next to the 56 and they're like, wait a second, that doesn't look right. Yep. Somebody added a 2 to this.
Yeah, probably. It's probably what happened. And that's natural. You know, that's not all editors. We don't expect editors to necessarily know, you know, V6. And so I wouldn't be too surprised if that was something that went on there. I think the other one that's really weird that we can talk through is that there's differences between what the RFC says and what actually gets implemented, right? And I think Link Local is a great example of this. So we see all the time the Link Local address space FE80::10, right? That's what's technically written in the RFC. That's what you're supposed to have available, et cetera, et cetera. Behavior-wise, I don't think that's what we see happening in terms of implementation. I think it's much more common to see it as a /64, and that you're not supposed to be playing with any of the additional nibble bits that are available inside that FE80:, right? You're not supposed to be stuffing extra stuff in there before you get to the last 64, even though I've seen people try, right? I've seen people try to mangle or play with some of that. And it is possible to play with some of that, but the behavior of the link is still as a 64.
Yeah, that's what all the programming around neighbor discovery is expecting to see.
Yeah, and so that's an interesting sort of, it's not like the address isn't legitimate and doesn't use it, but in terms of behavior, it's really a 64.
Yeah, so as a general rule then for the listener, we can just say, look, I mean, you see that that's a /10 that's held in reserve, but you'll only ever see a link local really as a /64. That you'll only ever see the FE80 prefix and then 64 bits of interface ID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unless you manually set something up, in which case it'll still shoot the address out there, but you could get some weird behavior based off of doing that.
Yeah, fortunately, you don't have to interact with Link Local very often. If you do, you're going the opposite direction, right? You're just shortening the interface ID or something.
Yeah, FE80::1. Make that my default gateway or my next hop default gateway, right? So something like that you'll see. So I think that's a really good set of examples around how some of that would work, because it's pretty fascinating to see people trying to do subnetting and in different prefixes in Link Local. And I've gone to places and they're like, absolutely, we've done all this stuff and we've done all this work in Link Local address space. And I'm like, that never leaves the link. what are you doing? Like there's no point to it, right? You could reuse the same link local addresses over and over and over again on every single link, every single unique link that you have, and it wouldn't matter one bit, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We have the scope or zone ID to help us identify where we need to stuff that traffic at which interface. So even if they're the exact same address, FE80:1, and you're seeing that on multiple interfaces, that's still okay, because we tag that interface to it. So
we've seen people using the interface identifier. You have a lot of space there, and thinking creatively about how they can use those last 64 bits, instead of just doing ::2 as the first server and ::3 as the second server, you know, and so on, or worse yet, you know, it's 192.168, 123, and then it's just :: 123. Right. They copy it over or something like that. Even worse, but we've seen some large organizations being creative with how they can embed other information into the IID. You know, all my web servers will have a bit or have be noted this way in the IID, and all my email servers might be this, or servers of a certain kind, or embedding other kind of information in the IID, like information used for authentication of a user or a device, or using the IID kind of like a cookie to track some behavior or something like that, making it look like it's unique, or it just, oh, that just looks somewhat random. Oh, it must be using privacy or temporary address. It just looks like a random number, but no, it's using some kind of algorithm that behind the scenes is not exactly random and is taking some input fields to create an IID that is actually used for tracking purposes. So a little more nefarious, or maybe useful depending on the application.
Or if you're more on the creative / Etsy side, you can artisanally craft your interface identifiers based on what your customers really want to see.
I have only bespoke IIDs in my network. So uniquely crafted using a random number generator, a lava lamp, a Mandelbrot set.
That's a good point, because only us who build labs would be guilty of this, but the expansion components of using your MAC address to expand into an EUI 64 address, right? There's a specific algorithm you can use to go ahead and do that. And there's a unique identifier that's stuffed in the middle there. You can absolutely fake people out into thinking that this thing was built with, EUI 64 by just stuffing that in the middle, even though you can build whatever you want. Right? So you can fake them out about what you think was used to build the MAC address. You can actually lie to them and tell them something different and stuff it in there. And so you can't trust that just seeing that identifier tells you that it's actually EUI 64. Mm-hmm. Right. And I used to play around in the lab and do that and set it up and completely lie to everyone and then have the students try and figure out what the MAC address was. And then they back calculated and it was something totally different. And I'd be like, here. It's like, well, hold on a second. How come it didn't work? And so it didn't work because I manually set up the address and I lied to you.
Right? And I hope you've all learned a valuable lesson to never trust that poorly.
Well, I mean, but what it shows you is that you can't necessarily trust what's in that IID, right?
In terms of
saying like, yes, this was generated with EUI 64, right? And that the algorithm worked the way I expected it to.
Yeah. Or you're using that input as well as a bunch of other variables to do, host OS fingerprinting.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I think it's a Linux host because it's using, EUI 64 still.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. Or assuming what set of drivers or interfaces it's using because it's got, that manufacturer number associated with it, right? And it's the same sort of thing. So maybe if you're trying to target, an HP NIC or something, it wouldn't necessarily work that way. And I think we, as a general rule of thumb, we just recommend that, the randomization makes the most sense. And now with the new thing that Apple and everyone else is doing, and I think we've probably seen some chatter on Twitter about this, about the randomized MAC addresses, right? The new new rotating randomized MAC addresses, sort of aggressive rotation of MAC addresses around connections. This will come true for V6 too, right? From both a temporary, but also the permanent address you get. Your permanent address will start rotating based off of this randomized MAC address too.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's it's going to be harder and harder to sort of keep track of clients based off their MAC address. I think the old days of thinking that your identity is somehow tied to that will start to fade away over time, and there'll have to be other ways to identify what an NNCO's client actually is and what their associated identity is with that.
Yeah, it's just IPv6 just gives you a lot of freedom, a lot of creativity, more address space, extension headers. We see creative use of extension headers. We talked a lot about that with Jeff Houston. Mm-hmm. And there's RFC 8250 IPv6 performance measurements using a destination option header and some timing in there to create some round trip time measurements over the internet or in private networks. variety of other things you can do, you know, with an extension header for telemetry purposes.
Yeah, that's a bit of weirdness, like, you know, in terms of, I guess that's important for shops that really want to measure and look at performance around what they're doing. But, it takes all kinds in terms of what's possible in there. I think one of the things that we saw article-wise not long ago, Dan York actually replied back this one, right, was there was an article talking about the Chinese government, I think, wanting to implement IPv6 for very specific, quote-unquote, tracking reasons. And then one of their arguments was the sort of unique value of V6 and the IADs, and they could assign these things to people and be able to track them no matter where they go. And I don't know how realistic that is, but it was one of the use cases that was made around it. And it was an interesting article. I don't know how true it is or if that's real. I don't know if you guys had any thoughts about it, but I was sort of like, that's a little strange. I don't know if I really buy into that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we often think that because of the lack of NAT in IPv6, that the source address may be more authentic or more trusted because you think it hasn't been modified in transit. But, you know, we've seen that the IID could change rapidly in evidence of temporary addresses. So you don't really have this measure of authenticity of the addresses. You may not really know who's who on the network to track behavior on the internet. So I guess that's some of it. You could change your own address. You could locally administer your own MAC address, and that would cause the temporary addresses to change for the privacy address to change.
Yeah. I don't know if this is something where they were talking about forcing manufacturers to put some sort of, we're going to force conformant. If they log in with this, we'll always build a virtual IAD with this tracking information in it so that it's included as almost like a cookie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's a packet level cookie as opposed to something that's happening at, HTTP.
You could put, identity or two-factor authentication information into the IID as well as a means of creating an authentication mechanism for two-factor, or for zero trust network or...
Yeah, and that's an addition
related to single packet authentication or mutual TLS somehow, indicate to the server that you're the client that they should open up the connection for, but everybody else, kind of a software-defined perimeter. You move through a controller that authenticates you and then allows only packets connected from an address to communicate with that service. So it's a closed, user group application, but it's really zero trust in a way. Must force authentication before you're allowed to make the application connection. So there could be some things there, legitimate ways that the IID would need to be changed.
Yeah. And you're going to have some sort of application control to trigger that, right? I mean, I can't imagine. I'm not aware of any OS having any API call that you're going to be able to make to say, like, please do this for me.
It could be an out-of-band technique or something requires a software agent.
Yep. Yeah, and perhaps we have to wait until there's just much more wide adoption of IPv6 before you start to see some of the leveraging some of the ability to do that with IPv6 as a protocol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you could have as many addresses as you want. So that's the other thing is you could say, just please make me another address with this characteristic. And then when it's my traffic, please source it from this address. Everything else, just use your other temporary address or to go ahead and do what you want. Mm-hmm. And that's an odd state. I guess that's an odd statement for if in V4, you can't imagine that you would just set up another random address, V4 address on the same hardware.
Yeah. It may result in some balkanization of the space that was sort of conceived as being something that would restore the end-to-end model, true peer-to-peer communication because everything has a public address. But it's not impossible to imagine there might be special ranges of addresses that are allocated for these types of applications and that aren't supposed to be on the internet, et cetera. So, whether they show up in the DFC or in the WAN is to be seen.
Right.
Yeah, another use of an extension header is for segment routing. Routing, SRv6. Mm-hmm. So other ways to, route traffic, control traffic.
Well, and I don't know if that's weirdness. I think that's by design.
Yeah. But it's a creative use of a header.
Yeah, absolutely. to be able to be able to do some interesting
things. And where does that line exist really between weirdness and by design? Does anybody really know? Or is it a genius or is it insanity?
It's both. It's both. That's what the definition
is. Don't know until you try.
Well, on Like Week 6, we've run out of space for this podcast. You can reach us on the IPv6 Buzz podcast on Twitter or at IPv6 Buzz. You can also hit up each one of us on Twitter too. If you want to hit Tom, it's at IPv6 Tom. Scott's at Scott Hoag, and I'm at E. Horley. And thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. If you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes or listen to us on Spotify. I don't know if they do the rating things or not because I don't use it very often. if you like this podcast, we recommend you check out Heavy Networking, Day 2 Cloud, Network Break. There's just a bunch of great technical content over at packetpushers.net. So definitely go over there and check it out. And so long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.